I believe I was a Tibetan in my previous life. I went to Tibet. Actually, Allen Ginsberg pointed my way to Tibet in 1989. I was interpreting and translating for Allen Ginsberg, who brought the first group of Chinese poets from China. And I traveled with them, and that's how I actually started writing poetry, because of this process. It was a 3-month process. And I was working with Alan pretty intensely every day to prepare and then to travel. At the end of the festival, Alan hosted a party in his apartment in Lower East Side, and he had tankards over his bed, and the Chinese poets pointed at the tankard. You're not supposed to point at tankard, by the way. You have to do this, right? And what's this? And Alan started talking about Tibetan Buddhism, and he turned out to be a very devoted Tibetan Buddhist. And then he got really excited about the violence, you know, and the bloodshed in Tibet. And the Chinese poets, it's kind of amazing, they didn't know what tankard is, but they know, they kept telling Alan, oh, it's all over now, monks are fine, Chinese are giving a lot of money to Tibetans to build temples. And Alan just suddenly just started, what the F do you know about Tibet and me? And I said, Alan, I'm just translating for you, why are you swearing at me? And he walked away and came back with like a pile of his rare books. And he just started drawing Buddha on the books and said, my apology to yell for Buddha and R. And he drew Buddha and lotus. And I thought, I would like to go there and see what's really going on. So the next year, I got my green card. That's the first trip I went back to China to go to Tibet to see what is going on. And the minute I stepped my feet, stepped on the land of Tibet, I just felt I came home. So I've been back many, many times, and I've been to Mount Everest 3 times, and I'm going again from the Nepal side next year. And Tibet. Every time I went there, I always saw just machine guns and armies and troops and just checkpoints everywhere. And I just thought, well, if you can send all the troops to Tibet, you're not going to change or conquer Tibet, because the mountains, you have to go there and see, right? It just changes your life and mind forever. It's just so high, so close to the sky, right? And humans are just really nothing. So, but when the railroad, the Qinghai-Tibet Railroad, I don't know if you know anything about this railroad, it's the highest railroad on earth, and they call the Steel Dragon across Tibet Plateau. And when I heard the railroad started, I just thought, oh boy, that's the end of Tibet. Yeah. And so I went there when the railroad just opened up and to do my research, and just devastating. So, and I'm also a Tibetan Buddhist, and actually in May this year, I did a 1-month show at the soap factory. The main component, there are many things. I brought the 100 artists along the Yangtze River and Mississippi River. The main thing is, like, we build a platform with water around it, symbolize the two rivers. And in the center, we build a 1-month-long sand mandala. It's a mandala of peace and compassion. So, but the most and the most subtle changes that happened in Tibet is the temple, all those monasteries. And so here's one of the scenes that I wrote for the change. Young monk at debating court. 15 yuan, said the young monk guarding the gate, a thick pad of cash in his hand. Since when did you start charging money? Last time I was here, everything was free. the debate, the monasteries, I put on my best smile. The boy monk took his job a bit too seriously. Read the sign, he said with a stone face, pointing to the tree in the yard. If you take photo in this debating courtyard, you should pay 15 yuan, please. The sign was hung high on the oak tree. I smiled again as I suppressed my urge to point out the grammar and the spelling mistake in the sign, and started to explain that I was invited by an older monk, a friend I'd met in the temple an hour ago. He told me his secret plan to enter India via the Himalayas. He wanted to meet the Dalai Lama, but my friend had wished vanished in a maroon sea of monks who were clapping their hands and jumping in the air as they debated the Buddhist Sutra. I didn't know why I was doing this. I could easily afford the fee, but something in me didn't want to. I'm going to close the door in 2 minutes, declared the young monk. I yanked out a 100 yuan note from my wallet. I don't have the change. Yes, you do, I pointed to the hand clutching the crumpled notes. I said, no change. His face remained hard. He knew I was a Han Chinese tourist, desperate to take photos. Keep the rest of the money, I said, slipping my foot into the closing gate. 15 yuan, he said through the crack of the old gate. We stared at each other. He was young, no more than 13 years old. His cheeks chubby with baby fat, yet his eyes were already hardened. They already knew the power of money. The debating went on inside, still thunderous and lively as I remembered from 10 years ago. Yet everything had changed in Tibet. The railroad and market economy had entered the plateau. I found 15 yuan in my pocket, just as he was about to lock the gate. Here it is, I shouted, and shoved the money into his hand. I raised my camera and got close, really close. I didn't ask for his permission. I didn't need to. I had paid my due, so now I owed him, the young monk, and everything in the debating court, everything that was for sale. I cursed myself as I took my shots, one after another. The young monk turned his back, his head hung in the silence of thunders.
My wife Meredith and I were in Qinghai in 2011, the Qinghai Lake International Poetry Festival, met Shi Chuan there, and we went to a few other places, saw the Terracotta Warriors, and then in Beijing she buys this little trinket, this solar-powered prayer wheel, and I'm like, what are you buying this tourist shit for? And we put it on our car, we only had one car at the time, my car, and now it's just the coolest thing ever, because we live in Seattle, and it's a solar-powered prayer wheel. So, I did too, right on the dashboard. Well, this first poem is about that. From October 20th, 2011, Seattle Day, wondering if the solar-powered prayer wheel will turn. March, I usually have a, when you write one a day for 14 years, you're usually going to have a wink. Somebody talks about someone who talks too much, and I said, oh, I have a poem about that. It says, Carolyn says, I don't know what to say, and then she keeps on talking. All right, so here's a few more American sentences, a form that Ginsberg created. March 2, 2012, in the dream I'm going down on her, but wake up licking my bike guard. I guess it's good that the mother-in-law laughs at that one. Okay. April 17th, why pick up after your dog if you just throw the shit bag on the lawn? May 31st, 2012, not unlike a fart, he rolls down car window to let out bad music. June 11th, 2012, one daughter drinks formula, one root beer floats with whipped cream flavored vodka. August 10th, 2012, the bad saxophone busker playing Killing Me Softly with his song. Killing Me Softly. I did that with a saxophonist and he hammered that one. September 9th, 2012, Border Patrol perfecting bureaucracy one cavity search at a time. October 5th, two wired on Hua Yen and white tea to see the tailgating moon. January 20th, 2013, only a white person would try to strangle someone with their dreadlocks. February 26, 2013, the winter fly died trying to get inside the disposable diaper. Oh. Ripping off caraway, you know the caraway thing, yeah. This is totally quotes, I think it was Meredith from April 26. Her feet are dirty, her hands are yellow, and I think she ate some dirt. And the next day, April 27, my penis is much longer in my dream than it is when I wake up. August 9th, 2013. I said, at least I'm not bleeding from the genitals. She said, not yet. And August 24th, 2013, asked the guy in the medical marijuana shop if he'll front some.
So we're going to do one more round after this. Is it?
I think we got the time for it.
Does that make sense? One more? So I'll read one now and then one the next time around. Well, I hope you're all enjoying this. I know I am. This has been an absolute delight. Thanks so much for inviting me, Paul, and for everybody who's here. I'm very, very grateful.
Thanks for setting it up.
Yes. So in the spirit of Thanksgiving, I'm going to read one. This is called A Turkey Feather for Writing with Wine. A turkey feather turns its key, quilled and scented of grape peel. A snowman's altar beverages all known pipelines to this page. Reduced to a weeping pool of butterfly halos, the maid to Mr. Orange Sparks, who shoots them from his open mouth when he grits and grinds his teeth, is forced by him to sell herself in vials as liquefied LSD, from his meanness of metallic sky to dealers who soak her onto the paper licked by Thanksgiving family feasters for dessert. No replacement for slices of night pie with concrete crust. The acid is a second treat so that slavery can be tripped on in its true American submission to the floor of the squares knelt upon containment. It's a place to sit down while chewing up and swallowing the front porch of one's ego, because it's not attached to a house, only instead the jaws of a cliff's swing, ready to take the hinges of manhood down its throat, home and all. So who consumes the skin of these pages? Muse says, apples have harmed the seeds in the envelope I've sent with a psychedelic stamp to the room at the bottom of the fall, where the power of mind to wander has been surrendered in full prostration to this poem's opening heart, gladly. Thanks.
Through these eyes, the ghost of a friend not yet dead invites me out for beers. We appear as smudges in patches of ice along treacherous February sidewalks. Afraid to move, I offer to take his arm. He shakes his head. No, take the other arm. He whispers as if it were a family secret. That one's paralyzed. The closest tavern is a falling star. We sit at the bar and laugh at tourists throwing money at the ceiling, hoping it sticks. Cemented to the counter is the beer he must drink through a straw. A woman enters carrying a puppy. The dog peeks out from behind her scarf. The bartender gives her a warning look. But look at those eyes, my friend pipes up. His eyes are two defeated empires. The bartender relents. The woman puts the puppy in my friend's lap. The dog soon falls asleep in the crook of his paralyzed arm. The tumor buried at the crossroads of his brain keeps each sphere from reaching the other. To walk becomes an abstraction. To see becomes a subtlety. To touch is a memory. Let me show you something. I watch as he rolls a cigarette with one hand. Pretty good, eh?